hello and welcome to Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. Why do we disagree about climate change? Climate scientist and author Mike Hume wants a radical change in the way we talk about this biggest of environmental problems.
The interviewer as well, he was saying people can talk about Shakespeare, but should they also be able to talk about... And then he was kind of stuck with for something to say. And it sort of went something complicated about science. And he couldn't even say something, you know, which represented the Shakespeare side of it. You know, the second law of thermodynamics, for example.
50 years on from C.P. Snow's lecture on the two cultures of art and science and how they don't communicate properly, where are we now? Is the debate relevant today, or are the arts and sciences further apart than ever before? All that, plus a male contraceptive injection, the bizarre research ideas that could improve our health, and why cancer patients should avoid extreme diets. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Hello and welcome to all our listeners. On the panel with me today is Nature's one and only Jeff Broomfield. Jeff, welcome.
Hello, nice to be here.
I listened to your debut on this podcast a few weeks ago with Ian Sample presenting. How was that?
Well, it was fine, I guess.
You were incredibly erudite, I have to say. But he told me afterwards that you had been out late the night before doing karaoke. Is that the case this time?
Are we going to have...
Our special guest this week is Mike Hume. He is a professor of climate change at the University of East Anglia and a founding director of the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research. He's published more than 100 peer-reviewed journal papers and 30 book chapters on climate change topics. In his new book, Why We Disagree on Climate Change, he explores how this subject has become so dominant in politics and why we need to possibly rethink what climate change means to us all. Mike, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, let's get right in here. You're a climate scientist. You're not someone who's saying that climate change doesn't exist, yet the thesis of your book is quite surprising for someone with your background. Why do you think that – one of the things you say, actually, is that science is too dominant in this debate. Now, from a scientist, that might sound odd. Do you want to just take us through why you think that?
Let's get this out of the way right at the beginning. I mean, there's no doubt at all that humans are altering the way in which the physical climates around the world are evolving. I mean, I'm not challenging that orthodoxy in any sense. But the two things that really drove me to write this book – one was to try to understand just why it is that climate change has become seemingly the environmental issue beyond all other issues that motivates and drives policy, public engagement, campaigning. And the second is, given that, why 12 years after we've had an international agreement, the Kyoto Protocol, why is it that we seem almost as far away from bringing climate change under control as we were 10 or 15 years ago. Nothing actually seems to have happened in terms of the headline indicators of climate change. I've been working in this field for all of my professional career, 25 years or more, and I've seen the issue evolve over that period of time, and I've been involved in IPCC assessments, I've been involved in various policy advisory committees. But it troubled me as to why these two things happen.
Do you think it's not the most dominant environmental issue?
Well, what I'm trying to do is to say that if we think that we can, by some great global collective effort, bring climate change under our control, then I think we're going down the wrong route. What I think we need to do is to use the idea of climate change, the reality of climate change and the fact that it shows many of the inefficiencies and inequalities and perversities in our planet today, use the idea to attend to environmental and social and political concerns that are more tractable. Because I actually think that the climate change is a too big a problem for us to pretend that we can solve as a species.
Which, I mean, that's quite a controversial thing to say for many environmentalists. I mean, many environmentalists will say, yes, we have to adapt. We have to understand where the climate's going so that we can live with it. But that distracts from this central goal of stopping emissions of carbon dioxide. What's the point of doing all of that adaptation if you're going to carry on putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and which we know is causing all sorts of problems?
I mean, it does take a rather different take on the problem. But I think what I've begun to see is that actually climate change opens up so many areas of dispute and disagreement and difference, both within societies and between societies. The idea that we can, in a way, put all of that back together globally and move forward together to reach one international goal seems to me to be just that little bit implausible.
What do you make of climate scientists and commentators who would fundamentally disagree with your premise, people like Jim Hansen or James Lovelock, even our own George Monbiot, who would say that you are distracting from that goal of trying to cut carbon emissions? They are very vocal in anything at all that doesn't look like it's going to cut carbon emissions or anything that looks like governments are shying away from dealing with that.
If we're actually trying to mobilise a political action around climate change, there is a diminishing return, it seems to me, about presenting climate change as this mega issue that if we don't attend to it in the next 5 years, then we've missed the boat. You actually end up distancing people from the issue. That's not the way that you're going to actually engage change in individual, collective, social behaviour. And it probably is not the way, as we have seen through the international negotiations, that we're going to make rapid progress on getting global deals. Whereas what I'm trying to say here is that if we use the idea of climate change as a way to attend to other environmental and social concerns that are maybe more local, more regional, more sectoral, where we don't have to get global agreement, and where individual citizens and communities can see much more immediately the benefits of taking certain policy or behavioural change, then actually that's a way in to this larger scale transformation of society that some of those advocates that you mentioned before are seeking to do. I'm not challenging that the ultimate need is for humans to actually live more sustainably on the planet. What I'm challenging here in the book is the way in which we can best move towards that goal.
So can you give us some examples? The idea that climate change is a big issue that as an individual it's very hard to get your head around, and in fact sometimes you would rather just ignore because it's too big, is I think very real. So your next step, I suppose, is to suggest, well, what can we do at our level, our individual levels, the local level?
The way in which we organise our transport in cities, issues around air quality, around congestion. These are very real, tangible environmental bads. Attending to those particular problems of improving air quality in cities and of minimising congestion are problems that can actually be much more tractably tackled than can the idea of certain actions saving the climate or saving the planet. And you're more likely, it seems to me, to make progress on engaging citizens, groups and individual communities in attending to those sorts of problems. And in the process of doing that, there will be some climate change gains.
What I'm hearing you say makes a lot of sense. And yet at the same time, I wonder, ultimately, not just for climate change, but for a lot of other areas of human endeavors, we become more global. It seems to me we're going to need more global cooperation. I mean, isn't there some intrinsic value in undertaking these treaties, even if they don't reach their goals, just because you're getting the world's leaders together, they're trying to cooperate, they're trying to do things. We need to start developing these frameworks now. So are you just saying we abandon these treaties or what?
No, I wouldn't say that we abandon them. I think what we shouldn't do is we shouldn't hang our hopes too highly on them. And I think one of the problems that we've had around, for example, the Kyoto Protocol is it's actually been a rather one-dimensional route into tackling climate change. And it's proved very problematic. We know notoriously, of course, about the Americans' withdrawal. But actually many of the people who've signed up the Kyoto Protocol, you wonder actually what they're really signing up to. So the problem with attaching too great an expectation on these international deals is that they will not deliver because of the political contestation and the geopolitics involved. And so and we actually hear now with the next big negotiating meeting coming up in December in Copenhagen, COP15, and some people are saying this is the single most important meeting that has happened in the entire history of humanity, and that if we fail in those 2 weeks, then where do we go from there? We can make much more rapid progress by attending to smaller scales, unilateral actions, local scale actions, where we're not trying to stitch everything together into one big global package.
this idea of COP15 in Copenhagen being the be-all and end-all, it suits the media narrative that this is the crunch point. But I don't believe that necessarily the scientists themselves, or politicians even, or people actually discussing at those meetings really think that that's true. I mean, already you're hearing rumors that the Americans, although they'll be there, are not necessarily going to be ready to make a deal, even though Obama is very pro-environment and has chosen some great advisors. So I'm not sure that it's necessarily true that the COP15 is going to be that important to the people who actually matter. But let me ask you this. Do you think that the focus that the people have given to climate change outside the sort of political and scientific worlds has damaged the cause?
There is an argument to play here. For example, the attention that we need to give to what are called the Millennial Development Goals, these 8 headline indicators that the world has agreed to try to achieve by 2015. And these are to reduce poverty in developing countries, to minimize child mortality, increase literacy rates, and so on. And the likelihood is that several of those Millennial Development Goals we will fail to reach by 2015. And there is a sense, it seems to me, that we've somewhat distracted attention away from high priority, relatively near term, and actually very, very achievable goals. If we think that actually bringing global carbon emissions down is difficult, and I think it is difficult, actually achieving the Millennial Development Goals is very, very simple. We know how to do it. It doesn't cost much. And yet we are not putting the effort or the resources or the diplomatic or the intellectual capital into achieving that. And even the MDGs, if we achieve the MDGs by 2015, that would have some real clear climate benefits because it would reduce vulnerability of many people to climate hazards. And it would also encourage a more sustainable use of low-carbon energy in those communities too.
Mike, thank you very much. We'll come back to you at the end of the programme as well. Mike Hume's book, Why We Disagree About Climate Change, is available now from guardianbookshop.co.uk. Let's look now at the stories that have been making headlines in the past 7 days. This is the News Jam.
News Jam.
New evidence has emerged to show that an extinct diminutive people known as hobbits belong to a new species of primitive humans and not modern pygmies. The 1-metre-tall, 30-kilo people are believed to have roamed the Indonesian island of Flores, possibly up to 8,000 years ago. The new anatomical evidence is based on the examination of lower limbs and shows that there were 5 toes, but the big toe was stubby, more like a chimp's.
81 projects have been awarded $100,000 grants by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in a bid to support innovative, unconventional global health research. The 5-year grants are designed to encourage scientists to be bold and hopefully make progress in preventing and treating infectious diseases, including HIV, malaria, and tuberculosis. The projects include genetically modified tomatoes that can make antiviral drugs, a skin laser to make vaccines work better, and giving mosquitoes a head cold to prevent them from sniffing out human food.
Cancer survivors who adopt extreme diets to stop the disease returning are wasting their time and may even be harming their health, experts have warned. The World Cancer Research Fund says dietary regimes which encourage drinking only fruit and vegetable juice, avoiding meat or dairy products, or taking large doses of supplements may not work. Dr. Rachel Thompson, the fund's science program manager, warned that cutting out food groups may lead survivors to become underweight, which could mean they're more susceptible to infection.
And finally, reports of a breakthrough in male contraception are premature. Last week's The Daily Express reported a phase 3 clinical trial in China of testosterone injections involving just over 1,000 fertile men. It found that the treatment caused no significant side effects, apart from increased libido, and almost completely suppressed sperm production, with fertility returning when the injections were stopped. However, the story failed to mention that only 733 men completed the 30 monthly injections and follow-up, a high dropout rate, but perhaps not all that surprising given that the men had to present themselves at a clinic every month and drop their trousers for a jab in the buttocks.
Jeff, thank you very much. Let's go over two of those stories. The first one about the Homo floresiensis, the new species of hominid, which was announced in Nature several years ago and has caused all sorts of problems from people stealing bones to claiming that this wasn't actually a new species of anything at all. It was just a human with a pathology. Jeff, take us through a bit of the history and why this new result is important.
Well, sure. So, I mean, I think the first thing to say is just why this is a big deal at all. And the situation is, you know, we are Homo sapiens. We came out of Africa. This is now generally accepted by pretty much everyone. The question is, did earlier species of Homo radiate out from Africa before us? That is, were there other more, well, not really primitive, but other species from the same group that left Africa first? And this has been a hotly contested topic amongst paleoanthropologists. So when the Homo florentiensis was discovered, this was very exciting, but it also raised a lot of questions because it appears to be more closely related to Homo erectus than it is to us. And that would imply that Homo erectus was actually the first one to get out and probably was all over Asia. It's quite a big deal in terms of human evolution.
So we had Dr. Alice Roberts in the podcast last week, who is presenting a whole new series of programs on how humans emerged from Africa and where they went and so on. And it's an incredible tale of, you know, our ancestors starting off somewhere in Ethiopia, or what is now Ethiopia, and moving across the world. Now, I suppose not many people think about things like Homo erectus and those sorts of species making out, because in this particular Homo floresiensis was found very, very far away from Africa. They made it a long way.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, that's what it looks like. And I mean, if they left, who knows who else left? That's what I find exciting about this stuff.
So the problem has been that some people argue that this was actually not a new species of hominid at all. It was simply a Homo sapiens who ended up on these islands and had some sort of illness.
That's right. I mean, well, we should say, I mean, there's really been only a few samples found so far of Homo florentiensis, or the Hobbit, as it's more commonly known. And so with the limited number of specimens, there's been an argument, and people are very passionate about this, that it was just a birth defect, essentially.
And the latest research published last week, what does that add?
Well, I think that a lot of paleoanthropologists would say that this really settles the debate, that there isn't much room for argument anymore. There's really two pieces of evidence. The first is the foot, which appears to be different than a human foot. Humans are designed for endurance running, and Homo florentiensis just can't do that. It has a foot more like a chimpanzee. So it was a good walker, not such a great runner. The second piece of evidence has to do with the skull. Now, there's been an argument that the cranial capacity of Homo florentiensis was so small that it couldn't be just, a dwarfed version of a hominid that had moved onto an island. But what they've shown by comparing it to dwarfed hippopotamuses, is that, in fact, this is probably a case of island dwarfism, which is a well-known evolutionary... I guess we probably should have explained island dwarfism.
No. I think our listeners will know what island dwarfism is, and if you don't, then just Google it. That's the best way. That's the way we find information out these days. I tell you, this human being sitting in my chair right now is not built for endurance running. I'll tell you that much right now, Jeff. Let's move on to another story, the male contraceptive injection. It seems to be a fraught thing, this, to try and find some sort of way of killing off sperm, I suppose, so that we can control birth rates or whatever it is you want men to do. What I found interesting about this was the story said there was no significant side effects apart from increased libido, which I'm sure for most men isn't a side effect in any way. But there were some problems with this study. I don't know. There was 1,000 people in it, but only, as you say, 733 completed the injections. I don't know, just put yourself in the mind of someone who wants to control their sperm production like this. Would you go for a monthly injection, Jeff, Mike, anyone?
No, I guess. I mean, you know, condoms, kids, they're safe, they're reliable, just use them.
Mike, what would you make of this?
I wouldn't subject myself to monthly jabs in the buttocks, that's for sure. If I wanted that, there are other ways of getting that sort of excitement.
Okay, well, let's leave that there. For more on all these stories, go to guardian.co.uk/science and also guardian.co.uk/environment.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
50 years ago this week, the scientist, novelist and civil servant Charles Percy Snow gave an influential lecture at Cambridge University's Senate House. Called The Two Cultures, in it he lamented the breakdown in communication between science and the arts, and how this contributed to the world's problems. The lecture caused a storm in the years following 1959, and led to noted literary critic F.R. Leavis dismissing C.P. Snow as a public relations man for the scientific establishment. Well, last week, scientists and artists got together at the Royal Society in London to discuss C.P. Snow's lecture and to ask whether it was still relevant today. One of the speakers was Sian Eady of the Gulbenkian Foundation. Here she talks about how, as someone with a background in humanities, she reacted on her first brush with science.
What struck me, and then particularly after a Damascene moment in the Wellcome Trust when I heard scientists talking about their work, was that here was a whole new way of looking at the world. And I immediately began to think that all the artists and writers that I were dealing with ought to be exposed to this completely new way of thinking. Because art thinking had moved on, of course, from the grandeur of Leavis's view. And you have to think of Leavis, it seems to me, as someone who was lamenting, I think, his what was in fact sometimes called as the Church of England without God. It's always represented for me by that wonderful couplet in Arnold's poem, which of course was a long time ago, that we are swept by confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night. We are in a godless universe. Well, scientists believe we're in a godless universe too, on the whole. But actually, there is a kind of vision that they have which we don't share in the arts. And I started analysing what this is. It's characterised through postmodernism, an area of study much scorned by scientists. And postmodernism declares there is no absolute truth. Everything is contingent, it is provisional, there is no clear, straightforward way of looking at the world. On the other hand, you scientist leaps out of bed in the morning with a view that there is a universe to be discovered and found out about. Now, there are two cultures within science, but there is a sense that there is a structure out there that is to be found. And I think in the arts we do not have that vision. And it may be because arts people are always bound and reminded by the fact that we are mortal.
That was Sian Eady. Also at the Royal Society debate was the pod's favourite mathematician, Marcus de Sautoy. He's a professor of public understanding of science at Oxford University. And here he is talking about why the two cultures still exist.
It sort of was summed up for me when I was interviewed by John Humphreys, actually when I got this Simonu professorship. And he said, you know, why should we be interested in science? And I thought, God, that's such a crazy question. He would never have asked that about why should we be interested in theatre or history or the arts. And it's sort of, I mean, I know he was trying to wind me up, which he did. And actually, I think this morning, Stefan and I were interviewed on the Today programme, and the interviewer as well, he was saying, you know, should people be able to come up, you know, they can talk about Shakespeare, but should they also be able to talk about, and then he was kind of stuck. With for somebody to say, and he sort of went something complicated about science, and he couldn't even say something, you know, which represented the Shakespeare side of it, you know, the second law of thermodynamics, for example. I mean, of course, science is important, and what people should be interested in. And I think you've both actually picked up the very strong political side of C.P. Snow's. Lecture, which is, you know, it could solve problems of poverty. That was what he was interested in. Issues of science affect the whole of society, and in order to be a democracy, we need to be able to understand the science to get involved in the debate. So I think it's probably even more relevant today. It's interesting, he also identifies what the problems are, and he identifies education, I think, as a big one, and I think that is still a problem within certainly English education system, is that we compartmentalise science and the humanities too much. And I think I would encourage actually much more interplay between the sciences and the humanities. You know, talk about the history of the subject within the science and talk about the science within history and see a little bit more fluidity between the two.
Mathematician Marcus de Sautoy at the Royal Society last week. Mike, Jeff, let's bring you into this. Mike, do you think that the two cultures debate is still relevant today? Are there two cultures still?
Well, I think the debate is certainly still relevant. I mean, I think the world is quite different, though, from C.P. Snow's world of 1959. This was before Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. It was before Harold Wilson's White Heat of Technological Revolution. I think the world we're living in now, 50 years on, science has actually asserted a much more significant place in our contemporary culture. And yet we also are aware of some of the limitations of science in terms of solving problems. And again, I come back to my thesis about climate change, that if we think that science or engineering or technology is going to solve climate change, then I think we have a very one-dimensional view of human reality. We do need to understand the way people feel and think and imagine and hope and vision for their future if we're actually going to make progress on climate change. And all of those things, our hopes, our feelings, our fears, our visions, those are things that the arts and humanities are very good at revealing and getting people to talk about in society. So I think it's a relevant debate to still have, for sure. But I think we're in a different place than we were 50 years ago.
Jeff, you're clearly in the science part of this, but do you look down on your fellow humanities students and graduates?
Well, I mean, I should say, first of all, I'm not as clearly as you might think. I come from a lovely liberal arts American education, and I have a double degree in science and English. So
science
I'm no
and
more.
English.
Yeah, I'm no more a scientist than I am a whatever English major. but just to take what Mike was saying a step forward, I do think that things have changed. I mean, you said that science is no longer seen as the way to solve problems. It is still the way to solve crimes, apparently. I was watching CSI last night. You know, it's a very scientific show, and it's just amazing, actually, how much, maybe not science itself, but the scientific mindset, the basis, the idea of empirical evidence and supporting hypotheses has really filtered into mainstream culture. I mean, CSI is an enormously popular show. And if you compare it to older crime dramas, I mean, they're always talking, just last night, they just kept talking about the difference between theory and, you know, what actually happened, and you need evidence. I mean, it's interesting. I think it really has sort of permeated a little bit.
Well, again, I'm not quite sure I'd go fully with you there. I mean, you can't solve crimes without science, I would argue, but actually science itself is not enough to solve the crime. So we know the classic problems about type 1 and type 2 errors in forensic evidence, and how you interpret the ambiguities in evidence is actually something that science itself cannot resolve. That comes down to human judgment, and if it's human judgment, then it involves all of those things that the arts and humanities have spent countless centuries trying to grapple with.
So the two things
have to work, you know, hand in hand here.
Well, we'll leave that there. If you want to hear the full debate, which features Sian Eady, Marcus de Sotoy, Government Minister John Denham, and Professor of Literature Stefan Collini, all chaired by Melvin Bragg, then go to the Royal Society's website at royalsoc.ac.uk. A quick reminder now about our book club. This month, Tim Radford is poring over The Age of Wonder, Richard Holmes' magnificent biography of some of the great adventurers in the world of science at the turn of the 19th century. Here's a taster. In this vivid passage, Holmes describes the young, deeply obsessive astronomer William Herschel at work with his sister Caroline, polishing a huge mirror for one of his homemade telescopes.
Sometimes she even provisioned William while he worked, literally putting drinks and bits of food into his mouth. On at least one momentous occasion, this extraordinary provisioning process lasted for 16 hours without a break. It was as if Caroline was a mother bird feeding a demented nesting. Much later, Victorian illustrators would make this into a comfortable domestic scene, a harmonious couple in an elegant drawing room with convenient refreshments on a nearby table. In fact, these epic polishing sessions took place downstairs at the workbench of the unheated stone flag basement in New King Street. Here, William and Caroline were surrounded by tools and chemicals and the distinct pungent smell of the horse dung moulds. It was dirty, monotonous, and exhausting work, for which they wore rough clothes and ignored ordinary household routines and niceties.
That was a section from The Age of Wonder by Richard Holmes. Go to guardian.co.uk/science to get involved in the book club discussion. A heads up on next month's book, by the way, it's Blank Slate by Steven Pinker. That's all about the developing human brain and asks, to what extent is it moulded by our early experiences? Well, that's almost it for Science Weekly this time round. Before we go, though, just one more question for Mike Hume. Mike, the arguments you were touching on at the end of when we were talking earlier were along the lines that Bjorn Lomborg is also heading. His argument is simply climate change is happening, but we've only got a certain amount of money. What do we do first? And he would rather you solved malnutrition in Africa before you went off and shoved cloud seeding equipment into the air or something like that to stop climate change. How does your book sort of approach the same subject like that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm coming at climate change from a different starting point than Lomborg. I mean, Lomborg was looking at this from a very much an economist's angle, looking at cost-benefit analysis. What I'm trying to do in my book is to introduce a much wider, richer cultural perspective on climate change. And in a way, I'm not trying to say these are the top five things that we should be doing because they're cost-effective. What in a way I'm trying to say is that by understanding our cultural and social and political and ethical systems, these are the things that we're most likely to make progress on. I mean, they may not be Lomborg's top five, and they probably won't be the top five things that the negotiators in Copenhagen might be negotiating in December. But I would say that they're the top five things that we're most likely to actually get our citizens and our societies and our communities behind and make progress on solving. But to do that, we have to understand this much richer cultural, social, ethical context in which environmental and scientific problems play out.
Do you think that some people might take away the message from your book, despite the fact that you have lots of solutions in here and things that we could do that are positive, that they might, that the tone might come across as being, well, let's give up on climate change. We can't do anything about it. A bit defeatist, perhaps.
Well, I hope they don't take that from it. It's not written from a defeatist point of view. I'm actually very optimistic about the future. I think humanity is humans are an amazingly innovative and creative species. We're also quite perverse and stubborn and can be very violent as well. But I'm actually quite optimistic about the future. So I hope people don't see it as defeatist at all. But what I do hope people take from the book is that we have to see, if you like, the 360-degree picture on climate change. We have to see it, yes, its scientific dimensions, its environmental concerns, its economic aspects, but also the fact that it's a cultural and social and ethical phenomenon as much as anything else. And without that 360-degree view, we probably are going to be going down some blind alleys.
Well, Mike, thank you very much. Mike Hume's book, Why Do We Disagree About Climate Change, is available now. Thanks to him, and thanks also to Jeff Broomfield of Nature. Remember, you can keep up to date minute by minute with what's going on here in Guardian Science land using our Twitter feeds. Look for The Guardian Science and Science Weekly. Until next week, I'm Alok Jha. The programme is produced by Scott Corley. Thanks for listening.